Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
There's gold fever on the streets of St. Paul.
$1 billion con.
We finally hit the big time.
A jackpot.
There was no sign of anything that was amiss.
Everybody wanted to get rich.
The $6 billion gold scam from the BBC World Service and CBC. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
It's too good to be true. It's too good to be true.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach, and in the early hours of Sunday, the 19th of May, these are our main stories. A senior member of Israel's coalition government has threatened to pull out unless the cabinet agrees to his post-war plan for Gaza within 3 weeks. Georgia's president has vetoed a controversial law that critics say stifles free speech, but she can still be overruled by parliament. The jailed Iranian Nobel Peace Prize winner Narges Mohammadi is facing new charges after accusing the security forces of sexually assaulting women prisoners. Also in this podcast, ecologists in Costa Rica have completed one of the largest ever eco-acoustic surveys, recording the sounds of the forest. We begin in Israel with the tension at the heart of the government. A key member of Israel's war cabinet, Benny Gantz, has threatened to withdraw his centrist party from the Israeli government unless it agrees to a far-reaching plan for Gaza by the 8th of June. At a news conference, he demanded that the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, commit to a number of goals.
The people of Israel are watching you. You must choose between Zionism and cynicism, between unity and factions, between responsibility and lawlessness, between victory and disaster. If you put the national over the personal, you will find us partners in the struggle. But if you choose the path of fanatics and lead the entire nation to the abyss, we will be forced to quit the government.
Mr. Gantz has demanded that the Israeli Prime Minister commit to 6 goals, including the establishment of a post-war international administration for the Gazan territory. Mr. Netanyahu has always insisted that Hamas must be defeated before any such plan can be decided. Earlier, the opposition leader, Yair Lapid, told an anti-government demonstration in Tel Aviv that Mr. Gantz and another war cabinet member should resign. Our correspondent in Jerusalem, Paul Adams, told Oliver Conway more about Mr. Gantz's concerns.
I think his concerns really are the same ones that we heard expressed by another member of Mr. Netanyahu's government, the defence minister, Yoav Gallant, just a few days ago, which is the absence of what they both see, the absence of a clear plan, both for the conclusion of the war in Gaza, but also crucially for what happens afterwards. And so Mr. Gantz is doing something Gallant didn't do, which is to set a deadline of 3 weeks from now, after which he says that if the government does not adopt this 6-point plan, which he outlined, then he will withdraw his party from the coalition. So that is the kind of latest line of the very deep divisions that have become increasingly apparent the longer this war has gone on.
And what does it mean for the Israeli government? Is Mr. Netanyahu likely to change his position on this?
No, I don't think so. I think he'll call Mr. Gantz's bluff. I mean, the thing about this is, you know, Mr. Gantz can threaten to withdraw from the government, but he knows that he is not capable of bringing the government down. Mr. Netanyahu still has the support of the far-right parties. They are the ones on whom he relies heavily. And if Mr. Gantz does carry out his threat in 3 weeks' time, the government will survive. He knows that. And there are some sceptics tonight who think that it is unlikely that he will carry out his threat on June the 8th. It is, as I say, alongside the kind of impassioned plea for a strategy from Yoav Gallant. You really have two people who are held still in pretty high regard by some of Israel's allies, particularly in Washington. Two people saying we're on the wrong course and we need to do something about it. And for me, that is the return of naked politics after months in which you know, the government came together, the nation came together in the wake of the awful events of October the 7th. That sense of unity in the government, that is crumbling, and it is crumbling rather visibly.
And as you say, echoed by some of Israel's key allies. I mean, what is Benjamin Netanyahu's long-term plan for Gaza?
Well, that's the question they're all asking. Don't ask me, because I don't know either. I mean, that is the point. They want to know, do you intend to stay in civilian and military control of Gaza when the war is over? Neither of the two believe that that is a viable course of action. What form of future leadership are you envisaging for Gaza after, if and when, Israeli troops withdraw? You know, fundamental questions about what happens next. These remain mysteries, and Mr. Netanyahu has said who he doesn't want in control of Gaza. He doesn't want Hamas, and he doesn't want the Palestinian leadership in the West Bank. But he hasn't really said who he does want to have in control, and that is worrying the two ministers.
And how is this issue, and indeed this row, likely to be seen by the Israeli public?
I don't think they will be terribly surprised by it. These are not natural allies. They came together at a moment of national crisis. Mr. Netanyahu is regarded as both a great political survivor, but also a great political operator and manipulator. And I think, you know, this will be seen as a return, in a way, to politics as Israelis know it, which is kind of nakedly confrontational and with the prospect of a government collapse always just around the corner.
Paul Adams in Jerusalem. With key land crossings into Gaza closed or operating in limited capacity because of the fighting, some aid has begun entering the territory via a temporary US-built floating pier. The Israeli army said 310 pallets began moving ashore in what it said was the first entry of humanitarian aid through the floating pier. Satellite pictures showed more than a dozen trucks lining up on Saturday on the pier's approach road. According to US Central Command, around 500 tons of aid are expected to be delivered to Gaza using the pier. To discuss what differences this route will make, James Kumarasamy spoke to Sam Rose, Director of Planning for UNRWA, the main UN relief agency in Gaza.
It's been quite a complex, long-term and expensive effort to get this thing up and running. We welcome it. We welcome all efforts to get more aid into Gaza, and we hope that the flow will increase over the coming days. But it's a very small drop in a very big bucket now in relation to the needs of the people inside Gaza.
And how is that aid going to be distributed?
The aid will come on shore. It will go to UN warehouses, not UNRWA warehouses, and it will be distributed from there to the agencies who have been identified before it leaves Cyprus as the recipients, or as we call it, the consignees. But literally, when you're talking about 10 trucks worth of aid, and as I say, we hope that will increase in the coming days, it's very, very little. It's important that this doesn't distract from the attention on Rafah and the urgency of getting the Rafah and Kerem Shalom border crossings open to allow for shipments of aid to come in at the required volumes.
Yes, there was another call from the White House for those crossings to be opened. What is the current situation?
The current situation is that since the 8th of May or early May, when the operation in Rafah started, and it started with an attack by Hamas on an Israeli military post, that the flow of aid into Rafah from Kerem Shalom is essentially ground to a halt. We have been able to get small amounts in, but this is an active conflict zone. It means it's very complicated, it's very difficult, and it's very dangerous for aid teams to move in and out of the area close to the border crossing and get those supplies in. But we're talking of tens of trucks that have come in since the 8th of May. And before that, we were looking at 300 a day. So it's the volume through Rafah, Kerem Shalom, has really, really diminished. And we, as UNRWA, the largest agency, we're essentially out of supplies right now.
Sam Rose from UNRWA, the main UN relief agency in Gaza. The jailed Iranian Nobel Peace Prize winner Narges Mohammadi faces a new trial after she accused the security forces of sexually assaulting female prisoners. Her family say the trial, the fourth such case against her, will begin on Sunday. Here's Mike Thompson.
despite having spent 12 years of her life in jail. Rights campaigner Narges Mohammadi is far from afraid to speak out. Last month, she sent supporters an audio message from Tehran's Evin prison, accusing the Iranian government of launching a full-scale war against women. And she urged Iranian women to share their stories of arrest and sexual assault at the hands of the authorities. While Ms. Mohammadi's words may have inspired her many followers, they clearly didn't go down well with the country's hardline Islamic regime, who promptly filed fresh charges against her.
Georgia's president has vetoed a controversial new law on foreign funding that sparked weeks of protests. Salome Zurabishvili said the legislation was Russian in both spirit and essence and was an obstacle to Georgia's path to EU membership. Here's our correspondent, Rayan Dimitri.
President Salome Zurabishvili fulfilled her promise and vetoed the law on the transparency of foreign funding. The bill requires non-governmental organizations and media outlets, which receive more than a fifth of their funding from abroad, to register as bodies pursuing the interests of a foreign power. But the governing Georgian Dream Party, which introduced the legislation in the first place, can override the president's veto by simple majority. Tens of thousands of Georgians have been protesting against the proposed legislation for more than a month. They say its adoption marks a turning point for Georgia's democracy and believe that it will be used to silence government critics.
Ukrainian officials say nearly 10,000 people in the northeast of the country have now been evacuated from their homes since Russia launched a renewed offensive across the border. Glib Mazepa, who lives in the city of Kharkiv, told the BBC about life there over the last couple of days.
We have attacks of Russian air forces, which launched the gliding air bombs from the territory of Russia, and then they are flying towards Kharkiv. Like this afternoon, these air bombs, I think there were two, they hit the residential area, five wounded, including three kids. Yesterday, it was quite a lot of casualties, three killed, I think 28 wounded. And it was the fire that strong that we saw the smoke from our balcony. It was seen from all around the city.
Oleksiy Goncharenko, who's the Ukrainian MP who's been in Kharkiv this week, said Russia's advances were moderate, but he explained how the military tactics are still threatening the city.
They can't take Kharkiv, at least right now, definitely not. And I think in general, Ukraine has enough capacity to stop them from taking Kharkiv. But if they will advance closer to the city, and if the city will be within artillery range, that will cause an awful suffering for people, because we know Russian warfare playbook. They will just start to destroy the city.
Our correspondent Ziana Bespiatchuk is in Kyiv and told me more about what's happening in the northeast around the city of Vovchansk.
There are reports of fighting inside the town of Vovchansk. This is a small town nearby the border with Russia, but it's really very important because if, imagine, and there is a probability Russian forces advance there and seize some villages nearby this small town, then it might happen that the Russian forces will be able to target the city of Kharkiv itself, the second largest in Ukraine, with the artillery. It won't be even necessary for them to use long-range artillery. It'll be enough to use ordinary artillery to target northern outskirts of Kharkiv, which happened actually already to the city at the beginning of the war. And it was devastating for that part of the city.
And give me a sense of how Kharkiv is prepared for this, because as you say, it was very much under attack at the beginning of the conflict, but not now for many months. So how are people preparing for this new situation they're facing?
As far as I know from my sources in Kharkiv, there is no panic. It's already a typical situation. Ukrainians, they don't panic normally. And residents of Kharkiv, they have gone through so many attacks already since the beginning of the war. So it's very difficult to scare these people on the one hand. But on the other hand, there is a very clear understanding in Kharkiv and beyond all across the country that this particular city is really in a big danger now. And they need very much the reinforcement of their air defense. This is absolutely essential. The Ukrainian president Volodymyr Zelensky said it very clearly that Kharkiv needs at least two Patriot air defense systems to intercept Russian missiles and drones, which fly every single day and night in the skies over the city. Of course, now I think we might predict that there'll be fierce fighting and very big battle for the control over the areas around Vovchansk, because this battle will be about the control over the northern outskirts of Kharkiv.
Ziana Bespiatchuk with me from Ukraine. A close ally of the late Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny has vowed never to give up the fight against the Russian President Vladimir Putin, despite being badly hurt in a hammer attack in Lithuania. Leonid Volkov was beaten in March. The assault was less than 2 months after the sudden death of Mr. Navalny in an Arctic prison, for which the Kremlin was widely blamed. This report is by Laura Koonsberg, who's been speaking to Mr. Volkov.
Bruised and battered, but not broken, Leonid Volkov was assaulted outside his own home in March. His car window smashed, his legs attacked with hammers. He told me his attacker's message from the Kremlin was, "We know where you live. We can kill you. We are after you." Yet the close friend and colleague of the late Russian opposition leader, Alexei Navalny, says he's undeterred.
He asked us to never give up and to defeat Putin and to build this beautiful Russia of the future that Alexei dreamed of for so many years is the only practical way to preserve his legacy and to make his ultimate sacrifice not to be in vain.
Three people were arrested last month over the hammer attack, which Mr. Navalny's longtime chief of staff believes was ordered by President Putin's regime. Mr. Volkov told me there had to be military, economic and political pressure on the Kremlin, describing Vladimir Putin as the greatest threat to the world in 80 years.
Ecologists in Costa Rica have completed one of the largest ever eco-acoustic surveys by recording the sounds of the forest. Traditionally, researchers hoping to gauge biodiversity would count species or set up camera traps that capture images of animals moving past. But now scientists from Switzerland and other teams from Costa Rican universities have been listening in to ecosystems to hear how they change and to monitor their health. Giacomo Delgado was one of the lead researchers.
What we're really doing is taking the whole collection of sounds from an ecosystem, and we call this a soundscape. And we use this as an indicator of what's happening in the forest. And by taking the entire collection of sounds, we can tune in to the entire community assemblage, the whole congress of species that exists in a place, and not just the species, but even beyond that, right? So maybe how the wind sounds like through different types of trees, or how the rain lingers in certain ecosystems over others. And so that whole collection of sounds is really what we're after. And we use that as the temperature check for what's happening underneath the canopy. We kind of think of Costa Rica as the best example for nature recovery that we kind of have. They've done this incredible job of bringing back the forest, but the only real metric that we have of that recovery has been forest cover. And so what we were interested in finding out is beneath the canopy, underneath those satellite images of that regrowing forest, is the forest actually recovering in a way that makes it more similar to those intact, those reference forests protected in protected areas like national parks or conservation areas? And so that's what we aim to do. And our methodology is explicitly comparative in that way, trying to see which similarities or which ecosystems are kind of getting closer to that reference point.
The ecologist Giacomo Delgado there. And still to come, Lionel Messi, one of the world's greatest ever footballers. We'll find out how a napkin started his amazing career.
Everyone's talking about Briex, a small Calgary mining company that struck gold half a world away.
They sold a $6 billion gold discovery to the world.
They kept drilling, they kept getting good results.
Briex had found the one we all hoped to find.
Investors jumped at the chance to buy up shares.
Everybody was getting in on it.
Suddenly everybody in town was going to be rich.
But there was a problem. You see, the gold, well, it didn't exist.
There's nothing there.
There's no gold. This is a scam.
The $6 billion gold scam from the BBC World Service and CBC. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast. The man charged with attempting to assassinate Slovakia's Prime Minister, Robert Fico, has appeared in court for the first time. The authorities haven't officially identified him, but local media say he is 71-year-old Juraj Sintula. Meanwhile, doctors treating the Prime Minister have said he remains in a stable but serious condition and that they won't be able to move him for a few days. Our correspondent Bethany Bell is in Bratislava.
The health minister said Mr. Fico's health seems to have stabilized after surgery. He had to remove dead tissue from the gunshot wounds. He's still said to be in a very serious condition, though, and the deputy prime minister, who was also speaking with the health minister, said that it was unlikely that he would be moved from the hospital in central Slovakia, where he is, to Bratislava in the next few days. But the Deputy Prime Minister did say that they are able to communicate with Mr. Fico within what he called the limits of his condition. We've been hearing a great deal from the Deputy Prime Minister and Defence Minister, Robert Kalinak, as well as a number of other members of the Cabinet. They say they are meeting all the time, and as they said, they didn't feel it was necessary to appoint a caretaker leader. There's still an enormous sense of tension, shock, and real deep polarization here. A number of politicians from all sides have said they've received death threats. There have been mutual accusations of people stirring up hatred. The Deputy Prime Minister called on the country to be calm and to be tolerant, and also accused the opposition and the media of stirring up hatred. Critics of the government would say Mr. Fico is also very well known for his aggressive and very confrontational, polarizing style in politics. And a lot of people are very worried about how this will play out. Whatever is determined about the motivations of the gunman, they're worried that the polarization and the divisions in Slovakian society will take a long time to heal.
It's 15 years since the end of the civil war in Sri Lanka. Relatives of tens of thousands of civilians who died in the long-running conflict held ceremonies on Saturday to remember their loved ones who were killed. Many are demanding answers about what happened to those who went missing. The Sri Lankan military has always denied killing civilians. Here's the sound of a Hindu religious ceremony in the village of Mulivaikal, where many people died in the final phase of the offensive. My colleague Janan Chadil spoke to our South Asia regional editor Anbarasan Ethirajan and asked for more on the history of the conflict.
The Sri Lanka's Tamil Tiger rebels, they fought for a separate homeland for the minority Tamils who predominantly live in the north and east of the country. The war lasted for nearly 30 years, in which tens of thousands of people were killed. Especially in the final few months of the conflict in 2009 were quite brutal. And the international community and the rights group is accusing the Sri Lankan forces of indiscriminately bombing civilian areas. I was in the front line for days during this war. We saw how many villages were damaged, people living in refugee camps. And since then, the relatives of those killed, they have been assembling in this small fishing hamlet, Mulivaikal, in northeast of Sri Lanka. We heard the song from there, how thousands of people had gathered to remember those dead. And this is a very poignant reminder for those, the relatives who were killed, and also people who went missing after the war, and they are still seeking justice.
Yes, they're still seeking justice. What is the government doing to help them?
Now, the government says they set up various commissions, various projects to reach out to the Tamil community. But on the other hand, what the Tamils are saying is that what they were aspiring for, a political solution, giving more autonomy to the Tamil areas, they have not yet materialized. Their biggest complaint is about thousands of people who went missing. Some of them, they say, they surrendered to the military after the war. So what happened to them? So unless you get justice, then reconciliation is not possible. This is the argument of the Tamil community. On the other hand, the UN and other agencies have been putting pressure on the Sri Lankan government to conduct an investigation and then put responsibility, accountability for those who have allegedly carried out these killings and also disappearances. But the Sri Lankan government and security forces have always denied that they were responsible, and they blame the Tamil Tigers for using the civilians as human shields, and that led to these deaths.
There are less than 2 weeks to go until the general election in South Africa, and the former president Jacob Zuma has launched his new party's manifesto. He chose a stadium in Johannesburg to announce his plans, despite still awaiting a court decision about whether his name can be on the ballot papers for the MK party that he recently founded. Our Africa editor Will Ross told me more about today's rally.
It was a kind of party atmosphere in this stadium. Lots of musicians. Jacob Zuma also singing, as he often does at these kinds of rallies. And he talked about these elections being a time to change South Africa and make it a country for everyone. He gave a bit of a history of apartheid and talked about his role mobilising during apartheid. Then he talked about changes that his party wanted to make to the education system to help create jobs. And he talked generally about fixing South Africans' poverty challenges, but he didn't really set out a manifesto in clear steps. He actually, quite surprisingly, said after the election, the MK party would gather South Africans together and get them to help the party come up with policies, which was somewhat surprising. But it was more a kind of moment to make a bit of a splash and get himself in the news and fill a stadium.
We'll talk about the court battle, but also interested to know whether the MK party can actually do any damage to the ANC, his former party.
Yes, so it's slightly complicated in that there have been, over the years, now two parties that have broken away from the ANC, the Economic Freedom Fighters as well. And polls aren't that reliable, but there has been some suggestion that for the first time, the ANC may not get over the 50% mark, meaning that it would be forced to go into some kind of a coalition. It's still likely to get the highest number of votes by far, and it's still a bit of an unknown as to how many votes this MK party can garner. It's obviously very popular in KwaZulu-Natal, Jacob Zuma's home area, but it's a bit of an unknown as to how many people are going to move their votes away from the ANC.
And just a quick word on this legal battle that's still there.
Well, it's still a legal battle as to whether Jacob Zuma's name will appear on the ballot paper or at least allow him to stand as a candidate for parliament. It's a proportional representation system, but that's still in the courts. And of course, he also has a long-standing corruption trial hanging over his head.
Our Africa editor, Will Ross, with me. 25 years ago, fans of the original Star Wars trilogy flocked to the cinema to watch the much-anticipated prequel, Episode 1, The Phantom Menace. The George Lucas film introduced the well-meaning but clumsy alien character Jar Jar Binks, played by Ahmed Best. His performance sparked plenty of online criticism, taking the actor to what he described as a very dark place. Now Ahmed Best has come to accept and celebrate his role in the franchise. He's been talking to my colleague, Julian Warwicker.
I got the call to go to Leavesden, England, and be in Phantom Menace. I really still didn't know what I was doing. I knew it was something different. I knew it had to do with this new way of making digital characters, which had never been done before, using hybrid computer-generated imaging, live-action character. And no one shared anything with me until it was time to actually go.
Talk to me about the reaction that you then got.
There were a lot of people who wanted those movies to be all Sith Lord, all dark, all action movies. And the demographic for The Phantom Menace was young people. And Jar Jar Binks was like the perfect lightning rod for their disappointment. When Jar Jar came out, he wasn't very well received by popular culture.
What's puzzling about that is that people might decide to take against a character for the reasons that you've just described, but they took against you too, didn't they?
Yeah. The ire that came towards me was one that I definitely wasn't prepared for, especially at that time. You know, I was in my mid-20s, and it was my very first movie. And I was so excited about being able to be a part of film history. Mm. And because of the backlash that happened against me specifically, I wasn't able to continue that work. And it threw me into a very, very deep depression at the time. And because there was no such thing as like cyberbullying and online harassment, there was really nowhere I could go for any kind of help. You know, so I just retreated into my little one bedroom apartment in Brooklyn and didn't want to come out.
What got you out the other side of all of that?
Yeah, you know, it wasn't easy, you know, where I found myself standing on the edge of the Brooklyn Bridge and wanting to, you know, not go on. And if it wasn't for just a moment of clarity in that instance, I might not even be here today. It was this real kind of like rock bottom moment where I had to go, you have a lot more in you. You have a lot more art in you. This isn't the end. And you can go on.
Here we are 25 years on, and you've talked with great candor about the impact playing this part had on you and everything you went through afterwards. But you're obviously now still very proud that you did this, yeah?
Incredibly. Regardless of what my mental state was at the time and where I was, it's always been about the work, and it's always been about the pride in the work. And we all knew while we were doing it that we were doing something special and we were doing something groundbreaking. And that pride has never gone away.
The Star Wars actor Ahmed Best with Julian Warwicker. A napkin with a promise written on it from Barcelona Football Club to sign Lionel Messi has been sold at auction for nearly $1 million. Officials from Barcelona agreed to the deal while visiting a tennis club in December 2000. Our Europe regional editor Paul Moss has the story.
The auction house described the item on sale as a standard Spanish waxy napkin, though it's safe to say the buyer is unlikely to use it to wipe their mouth. It carries a written commitment from Barcelona Football Club's then sporting director that he'll sign the 13-year-old player Lionel Messi. The commitment was then witnessed by the club's transfer advisor and an Argentinian football agent, and it's seen as marking the start of what would become a phenomenally successful career.
Rakitic, Messi, Messi la pone!
No.
It's still not known who paid £762,000 for the napkin. For some, it'll be seen as evidence of the devotion Lionel Messi still inspires. For others, proof that when it comes to top-level football, crazy amounts of money will follow not just the stars themselves, but even any artefacts associated with their playing.
Paul Moss reporting. And that's all from us for now. There'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast to download later. If you'd like to comment on this podcast and the stories we included, drop us an email, globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk, or on X, we are at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Chris Blackwell. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Andrew Peach. Thanks for listening. And until next time, goodbye.
Everyone's talking about Briex, a small Calgary mining company that struck gold half a world away.
They sold a $6 billion gold discovery to the world.
They kept drilling, they kept getting good results.
Briex had found the one we all hoped to find.
Investors jumped at the chance to buy up shares.
Everybody was getting in on it.
Suddenly everybody in town was going to be rich.
But there was a problem. You see, the gold, well, it didn't exist.
There's nothing there.
There's no gold. This is a scam.
The $6 billion gold scam from the BBC World Service and CBC. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.